It's Sunday, October 8th, 2006. You're moving at the speed of creativity with Wesley Fryer, narrowcasting from Edmond, Oklahoma. Well, good evening and welcome to a special recorded podcast from today. I had an opportunity to participate really as just a listener, and I guess a question and asker at a couple points, in Global Learn Day today, which was in its 10th year, and this was a 24-hour synchronous series of presentations and conversations spanning the globe that really got to, address a variety of issues relating to access, equity, and the improvement of teaching and learning opportunities across the planet. And this was a presentation by Stephen Downs, and the title of his presentation was Learning Networks and Connected Learning. And I will include in the podcast show notes not only a link to Global Learn Day, but also to Stephen's blog and to the post on the Global Learn Day blog about his presentation. He also cited something called the future VLE, and talking about the future of learning and just what the different elements of a learning, I guess maybe a personal learning landscape would look like. And I really, really respect Stephen and his ideas about connected learning and distance learning, and in this case, what are the hallmarks or the characteristics of effective networks, and he went through 8 of these. Unfortunately, because of some scheduling issues, we were not able to have some question and answer periods, and as you'll hear in sort of the middle, there was a failure of the streaming connection, but I was connected via Skype and was able to hear all of Stephen's presentation, and he generously gave permission for me to share this out with you as a podcast. So he is going to be sharing a paper about this topic with IT Forum here in the next week. I think he said maybe on the 16th of October. And so be looking for that. I will definitely be looking for that and probably be posting a comment on that on my blog. And just want to say thanks not only to Stephen but to all the great presenters from Global Learn Day today, and encourage you to check out the recorded sessions, which I think they're going to be making available here following the sessions, which just wrapped up today. And also, I would encourage all of you to look forward to K-12 Online Conference, which is going to be starting here in about a week with the pre-conference keynote by David Warlick. So, without further ado, here is Stephen Downs talking about e-learning 2.0, learning networks, and connected learning.
What I've been on about for the last few years is something called Learning Networks and Connected Knowledge. And this is the title of my paper for IT Forum. And what I'm trying to do here is put together some of the recent events in the field of e-learning with some of the theory, and especially the pedagogical theory, that informs these recent developments. The recent developments are things like, or what's been called, e-learning 2.0. Now, what I want to draw your attention to first is that e-learning 2.0 is derivative. It comes from something called Web 2.0, a term popularized by Tim O'Reilly, which describes the evolution of the web into something like a read-write web. And O'Reilly writes, "The central principle behind the success of the giants born in the Web 0.1 era who have survived to lead the Web 2.0 era appear to be this: that they have embraced the power of the web to harness collective intelligence." And it's this idea of collective intelligence that underlies a lot of e-learning 2.0 and the new approach to online learning. O'Reilly cites an example of the difference between Netscape and Google. According to O'Reilly, Netscape saw the web as a software market. They released their browser for free, but this was in order to sell copies of web servers. Google, on the other hand, By contrast, never viewed the web as a place to ship some sort of product, but rather it became a service, harvesting the collective linking behavior of web users to create a more effective search engine. Now, this sets up an environment where we have two very different approaches to the web, and in O'Reilly's paper, he draws a bunch of examples out. The old Web 0.1, for example, was based on personal websites. Web 2.0, based on blogging. The old Web 0.1, we looked at screen scraping. Web 2.0 is focused on web services. Web 1.0 was based on publishing. Web 2.0 is based on participation. And again, we see here the idea that Web 2.0 is a place where we do things rather than a place where we consume things. Now, as the rest of the web went toward Web 2.0, in the educational community, we saw a solidification of the more traditional approach. We saw the learning management system become central and centralized with Blackboard purchasing WebCT, for example. We saw developers continue to emphasize content, software development. Learning object metadata was standardized. IMS developed and formalized the specifications for content packaging and learning design. But even so, even as traditional instructional software became more and more entrenched, it became difficult not to notice the very grassroots movement in the other direction. First of all, what we've seen over the last few years is an exodus from commercial software in favor of open source systems, such as Moodle, Sakai, LAMS, and others. And this indicates a desire of educators not merely to consume educational software, but to be involved in the creation of it themselves. Other educators issued educational software altogether, and a wave of them began to look at the use of blogging and the wiki in their classrooms. And this all led to the new distributed model of learning, which came to be characterized as e-learning 2.0. You know, I wrote my paper on this. What happens when online learning ceases to be a medium and becomes more like a platform? What happens when online learning software ceases to be a type of content consumption tool where learning is delivered and becomes more like a content authoring tool where learning is created? And the answer to that turns out to be a lot like Web 2.0. The model of e-learning as being a type of content produced by publishers, organized and structured into courses, and consumed by students is turned on its head. Insofar as there is content, it is used rather than read. And it is, in any case, more likely to be produced by students than by courseware authors. And insofar as their structure, it is more likely to resemble a language or a conversation rather than a book or a manual. Now, a lot of development has happened around this shift, and Scott Wilson has released a now famous future VLE document diagram, which outlines the structure of what's now being called the personal learning environment. And the idea of the personal learning environment is that, as Milligan says, it would give the learner greater control over the learning experience, managing their resources, the work that they've produced, the activities that they participate in, and would constitute their own personal learning environment. And the idea behind the PLE is that the management learning migrates from the institution to the learner. And as Wilson's diagram shows, the PLE connects to a number of remote services, some that specialize in learning, others that don't. Access to learning becomes access to the resources and services offered by these remote services. And the PLE allows the learner not only to consume learning resources, but to produce them as well. Learning, therefore, evolves from being a transfer of content and knowledge to the production of content and knowledge. E-learning 2.0 promises a lot. It promises, and a lot of what it promises has not been fully realized. It promises empowerment, for example. That hasn't been fully realized. Online learning to this day is still a little more than a handout published online or multiple choice quiz. But I'm going to have to edit those two paragraphs. Never mind. Okay. Anyhow, that's the basic introduction to e-learning 2.0. What I want to do now is take that and look at some of the ideas under it, underneath it. The idea of e-learning 2.0 might appear elusive at first blush. Many of the ideas central to e-learning 2.0, though, can be evoked through discussion of its fundamental architecture, which I've called in recent years learning networks. And the idea or the objective of the theory of learning networks is to describe the manner in which resources and services can be organized in order to offer learning opportunities in a network environment. So it's important to keep in mind here, learning networks, properly so called, is not intended to be a pedagogical principle per se, but rather a description of environment intended to support a particular pedagogy. I first introduced learning networks in 2004 in my other world tour, and I said in Perth, if, as I suggested above, we describe learning objects using the metaphor of language, text, sentences, and books, then the metaphor to describe the learning network is the ecosystem, a collection of different entities related in a single environment that interact with each other in a complex network of affordances and dependencies, an environment where the individual entities are not joined or sequenced or packaged in any way, but rather live, if you will, free. Their nature defined as much by their interactions with each other as by any inherent property in themselves. And I said, we don't present these learning objects ordered in a sequence. We present them randomly, unordered. We don't present them in classrooms and schools. We present them to the environment, to where students find themselves, in their homes, in their workplaces. We don't present them at all. We contribute them to the conversation. We can become part of the conversation. They are not just text and tests. They are ourselves, our blog posts, our publications and speeches, our thoughts in real-time conversation. Sigmund Freud, leaning on the lamppost, just when we need him. Now, this ecosystem approach, I say now, realized in software, is based on what might be called a distributed model of resources, as suggested by the personal learning environment diagram. And it's interesting and worth noting, I have a diagram here in my paper which I can't show you, but the difference between the traditional and the decentralized approach is that in the traditional approach, all of the resources are put in one place. Resources are all little boxes, and then one place, one big box surrounding them. But in the decentralized approach, there is no one big box holding all the resources, but rather you've got a whole bunch of little boxes all scattered around, and a whole bunch of little people all scattered around, and then everything all connected to itself. One of the things that I've often pointed out is that the original... You know, and people don't remember this, but online access used to be one of these centralized kind of systems where, you know, people had to dial into Prodigy or Genie or CompuServe or something like that, and they'd go to this special place where all the resources were contained, if you will, in a single box. And what happened was the web came on the scene, and the web wasn't like any of those services. It was distributed. There was no single box that you signed into. There were all kinds of boxes, as it turned out. You know, in the long run, billions of boxes, and the boxes were connected together. You didn't log into a single service called the web. You logged into one of those distributed boxes and then bounced around from place to place to place over all of those connections. Oops, gotta be careful here. Now, in a system like that. And now we're getting to the architecture part. In a system like that, the nature of design itself changes. This is a really important term. In a typical computer program, the design of the program is specified with something like an algorithm or a flowchart. And we describe software as performing a specific process with specified and often controlled inputs and outputs. But in a distributed environment, that kind of design is no longer on. The design is no longer defined as a specific type of process. but rather what designers need to do is to characterize the nature of the connections between the entities, and then it's the entities themselves that will determine what the resulting computer system does. Let's post this diagram onto OL Daily. Sure. I will. Well, it's the Scott Wilson diagram. There will be audio of this, won't there, John? So we can play back this audio at some point. I'm not recording this, so I really hope that you will. This is because I wasn't sure I could record and do the actual talking on Skype. So, okay. So now the question becomes, when we're looking at learning networks, the question is something like, what are the core principles that are going to characterize such a description? And the internet itself gives us a sound set of principles, and these are grounded by two major characteristics. Simple services with realistic scope. And I quote from an article on First Monday, simple service or simple devices with realistic scope are usually able to offer a superior user experience compared to a complex multi-purpose service or device. Or as David Weinberger describes the network, small pieces, loosely joined. Oh, and I welcome back the people who are listening on Real Audio. Nice to have you all back. To summarize what you missed, the internet is a network. Okay, moving on. Now the principles behind the internet may be realized. You know, these underlying principles may be realized in the following set of design principles. I'm going to list a bunch of design principles here. And what I want to point out here right now is that these principles describe not only networks, but also network learning. And they're intended to show how network learning differs from traditional learning. And the idea is that each one of these principles confers an advantage over non-network systems. Okay, so the first principle. Effective networks are decentralized. Centralized networks have a characteristic star shape, where some entities may have many connections, while the vast majority have few. This is typical of, say, a broadcast network or a teacher in a classroom. But decentralized networks, by contrast, form a mesh. The weight of the connections and the flow of information is distributed. This creates a balanced load, which creates a more stable network with no single point of failure. It's like that old saying, what do you do if the student or if the teacher dies while you're in class? Wait 10 minutes and then leave.
How do you know?
Well, that's just it. You can't. Second principle, effective networks are distributed. Network entities, network resources reside in different physical locations, and this obviously reduces the risk of network failure. And it also, very importantly, reduces the risk for major infrastructure, such as powerful servers, large bandwidth, massive storage. The most subversive entities on the internet have been distributed networks. Not just the web servers, although web servers are a classic example of a distributed network, but peer-to-peer networks like Kazaa, Nutella, content syndication networks like RSS. The emphasis on these systems is on sharing, not copying. If there are local copies, if they exist, they are only temporary. The third principle is that effective networks are disintermediated. That is, they eliminate mediation, the barriers that may exist between a source and the receiver. For example, a network will enable the bypassing of editors, replacing peer review processes with post-publication recommender systems. Or we can see the disintermediation of the news media, where the traditional news media broadcasters are being replaced more and more by networks of news bloggers. And in learning, we're seeing more and more the removal of the intermediate teacher that stands between knowledge and the student. The idea here is that in many cases online, the student can access learning and knowledge directly without the mediation of a teacher, a school, an institution, or something like that. Fourth major principle is that in effective networks, content and services are disaggregated. The idea here is that units of content or units of services should be as small as possible, and they should not be bundled. Rather, the organization and the structure of content and services is created by the receiver. This allows the integration of new information and services with old, of popular news and services with those that are of an individual's niche interests. This was the idea behind learning objects. And learning objects were sometimes defined as the smallest possible unit of instruction. Of course, what they did with learning objects is they took all of these pieces, they packaged them again, and presented them as courses, and that completely completely obviated the advantage that creating learning objects in the first place created. The next principle. In an effective network, content and services are disintegrated. That doesn't mean we use a blaster on them. What it means is entities in the network are not components of each other. What it means in practice, the pragmatic thing, is that the structure of the message is logically distinct from the type of entity sending or receiving it. The message is coded, if you will, in a common language where the code is open and not proprietary to a particular program or system or receiver. So no particular software device is needed to receive the code. And this, of course, is the idea of standards. John Hibbs is asking me to wrap up, and I will, John. I just got a few more principles to go here. Oh, 8 to 10%. No, I'm just kidding. An effective network is democratic. Entities in the network are autonomous. They have the freedom to negotiate connections with other entities, the freedom to send and receive information. In such a network, diversity is an asset, as it confers flexibility and adaptation. And it also allows the network to represent more than just the part. The whole of the network to represent more than just the part. The seventh principle, a network, an effective network is dynamic. A network is a fluid, changing entity, because without growth, or without change, growth and adaptation are impossible. This is sometimes described as the plasticity of a network. And then finally, an effective network is desegregated. We don't think of, in network learning, we don't think of learning as a separate domain from the rest of life. Learning is instead thought of as a part of life, a part of work, a part of play. The same tools that we use to perform day-to-day activities are the tools that we use to learn. Viewed more broadly, this condition amounts to seeing the networks as infrastructure. Computing, communicating, and learning are not something we go someplace to do, but rather these are things that are available to us in the same way today as electricity or water or telephones are available. These are the essential principles of networks, and these are the things that inform or underlie e-learning 2.0, as I've described it above. I'll stop there and see how things are going on the bridge and in the chat room and on the real audio and all of that.
Moving at the Speed of Creativity podcasts are independently produced and syndicated for a global audience by Wesley Fryer and are shared under a Creative Commons Attribution 2.5 license. Learn more at www.speedofcreativity.org.